Welcome to Coming of Age, a podcast that is changing the conversation on aging. I'm your host, Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. This season, season four of Coming of Age, we welcome an exciting roster of guests from around the world, thought leaders who are at the forefront of transforming seniors' living and care and are shaping the future for all of us as we age. Welcome back to a new episode of Coming of Age. We are all watching with great interest as countries, states, and provinces around the world hold elections. What are the priorities of voters, including here in Ontario and Canada, as we head into potential early elections? How are the voters' priorities shaping how political parties are planning their policies about healthcare and seniors' care, including long-term care? In a world of polarized politics, let's uncover common ground and offer insights that extend beyond Canada. This two-part episode dives into these timely issues, whether you're in Canada or abroad. Today's conversation provides a lens on how aging populations can influence elections and what that means for the future of seniors living and care. To start, we'll explore the insights behind Canadian voter behavior with David Coletto, founder, chair, and CEO of one of Canada's leading polling and public opinion research firms, Abacus Data. With a career spanning over two decades, David has devoted his life to exploring what people think and feel about their work and lives. Next, we'll chat with senior political strategists from the three major political parties in Canada. We'll hear from Ginny Roth, Gurratan Singh, and Dan Moulton of Crestview Strategy, one of Canada's fastest-growing public affairs firms, as they provide insights on where and how issues around seniors' care could shape each party's campaign. But first, let's dive into our conversation with David. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Arjo. David Coletto, welcome back to our podcast. I have to say, it really is a delight to have you come back. And this is really timely. So we've seen elections in the United States. We've had some elections across Canada. We hear a potential federal election, as well as an early Ontario election. So I'm wondering, David, what is the public mindset right now? And what are some of the things that we need to be thinking about as we navigate change?
Well, thanks for the invite, Donna. Great to see you again. One stat jumps out at me when we reflect on 2024. And that is, given all of the elections that happened at the national level globally, and there were lots, more people voted globally in 2024 than I think at any time in history, not a single incumbent government saw their vote share increase. Some were reelected, but everybody lost share, which is the first time that's ever happened since 1905. And so something was happening in 2024 that I think comes to the mindset that is also inflicting Canadians. I don't think Canadians are immune to it. We've seen many provincial governments lose share, get defeated. You know, in Nova Scotia, the Tim Houston government is the exception. In fact, it's one of the few global exceptions where we saw the incumbents there increase their vote share. And I think it's related to a mindset that I think has taken hold over the last 18 months in most of the public, regardless of what province they're in, what age they are, and that is one of scarcity. I think coming out of the pandemic and then the effects of the rapid rise in inflation and the corresponding increase in interest rates has left people feeling that the things they need in their life are harder to get. Now, depending on your life stage, if you're younger, those things are housing. Those things are economic security, the cost of living in particular. I would describe it from their perspective, punishing over the last number of years, and particularly this last year. If you're older, that cost of living, if you're on a fixed income, has also been quite worrisome, but you're also deeply concerned about the scarcity in the health system, that the capacity of the system coming out of the pandemic, whether it be primary care, emergency care, long-term care, regardless of what province you're in, you're feeling that that system is not meeting the needs that you have, and you're worried that if you need it, you're not going to get the care you need. And so you take that together, and this universal sense of scarcity is forcing people to, one, punish governments of all stripes. As long as they're the incumbent, they're getting punished. And two, I think it's driving us to a zero-sum kind of mindset and thinking, which is causing us to kind of create some conflict, right? Like, we're fighting over scarce resources in as wealthy a country as Canada. In fact, many countries in the West, the UK, the United States, much of Europe is experiencing the same kinds of phenomenon. And it's leaving us the really sour mood. Only one in five Canadians think the country's headed in the right direction. And that's the lowest it's been. It's lower than it was than even during the pandemic. So the mood's pretty sour there, Donna. It's not a great way to start this podcast, but it explains, I think, the political disruption and change that we have seen in Canada and the United States and around the world.
It's such an interesting issue to navigate. We were recently in the Netherlands, and they were talking about how 15 years ago, the focus in the Netherlands around seniors care was affordability. 10 years ago, it was about quality. Today, it's about accessibility.
Yes.
So whether you frame that based on scarcity, it is going to be interesting to see some of the shifts. You've already started to see some shifts around publicly funded, privately delivered care. And we've started to see the needle shift on that in Ontario. All long-term care is publicly funded, but we do have some private delivery in the system as well. So we're starting to see, I think, a reframing of some of the issues because people want care. I'm really curious as to your thoughts. Do the delivery systems actually really matter? Or is it just a question of I want when I want it, and I just have to be able to access something and then have some degree of confidence that whatever I'm going to access will actually meet my needs?
I think when things are scarce or they're perceived to be scarce or scarcer, our ideological kind of underpinnings loosen. We're less rigid in how things get achieved and much more open to experimenting. When I say experimenting, I mean like the public's openness to trying new things, doing things differently, right? It's like when you are faced with a really serious medical condition, you may be open to trying things that are still not fully confirmed to work, but you're just willing to try because nothing else seems to matter or to work. It creates a space for policy, experimentation, innovation, change. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to find no resistance to it, particularly on the private delivery. I do think there's still some apprehension. But at a moment right now where the public's trust in public institutions probably is not doing quite well, regardless of the jurisdiction. So I do think, Donna, yeah, there's less ideological consistency or rigidity to public opinion, especially on things like healthcare. That doesn't mean people are going to accept a two-tier system in which some get to pay and get access and others don't, particularly on the primary care and on emergency care. But in the long-term care space, and we've seen it, increased openness to accepting alternative models of delivery.
Great insights, David. As you look across the country and you've been pulling province by province, you've been looking at the issues, are there any material differences between the core issues in Ontario versus British Columbia versus Nova Scotia or Saskatchewan relative to the national priorities?
There are some variations, but they're not substantial. Actually, this is a moment where I've said, regardless of whether you live north, south, east, west, small towns, large urban centers, that issue list is the same. Now, there's varying degrees. So, for example, in Saskatchewan, housing is not as acute an issue because the affordability challenge hasn't affected all communities in Saskatchewan, although Saskatoon is seeing a slight increase in housing prices. But across the board, it is the cost of living, affordability, more writ large, housing and healthcare that really have focused the mind. Now, in Atlantic Canada and Quebec, healthcare higher up, more people say that's a top issue. In Ontario, housing, like in British Columbia, a little bit higher because of how acute the housing crisis is. But the story is very much the same. And what's really interesting over the last number of years is how we talk about a deep urban-rural divide politically in Canada, maybe culturally, but dividing us on that urban-rural axis are the issues. Because if you're in many rural or small town communities, housing affordability is a big issue. Healthcare access was a challenge in many small communities that are seeing their emergency rooms close weekends on end. right? But the same concerns about wait lists, access to care exist in big cities too, where you have more hospitals even there. So yeah, it's one of those moments where as much as we feel like we are divided politically, we're actually quite united on what is bothering us and what's keeping us up at night.
Well, it makes it interesting just from a leadership perspective, the ability to actually harness it for good as opposed to using it to divide. To your point, it can become a very divisive moment, or it could be one that really brings people together to problem solve. I think the question is, where's the leadership that's going to do that? And how do we make sure that we get our decision makers and influencers focused on the right issues? Certainly, we're all aging. Every province is facing this demographic shift. But I am wondering where aging fits in on the continuum and how the aging population could be driving some of these issues.
One of the biggest differences on when you ask people what are the top issues, Canadians over the age of 60 are far more likely to put healthcare. And I think you could lump in long-term care and other aging-related care needs into that group. It's a life stage process. When you're younger, you think you're invincible. You don't really think about the health system quite yet. Even if you might have parents who may need care, you're not quite there. But if you're in your early 60s, for example, odds are you might have aging parents still that need care, and you're really thinking about your own care. And so it is one of, I think, the most interesting and perhaps consequential issues that I think we're going to have to grapple with over the next 2 to 5 years, if not already, right? I think it's already acute. And I always hear this from political leaders that I talk to or elected officials or anybody. It's like, oh yeah, well, it's normal for Canadians to put healthcare on their top issue list. They always say that. And my answer as a pollster is no, they're saying it because it's real. They don't have to say that, right? They're saying it at the door. They're saying it in our surveys because there is a deep anxiety about the quality of, and I mean, full 360 care that's available, whether you are one of the 6 million Canadians who don't have access to a family doctor, whether you have parents on a waiting list to get long-term care, the effect of that is the same, which is anxiety and insecurity. And even if you have those things, you might be worried you're going to lose them and not be able to replace them. You know, baby boomers, we've had this conversation on an earlier podcast, you know, are the largest demographic still in the electorate. They're more likely to vote. They're politically a powerful group. And like at every other stage of their life, we've underestimated their impact. And what we're seeing is what I describe in a recent piece I wrote on my own Substack is this double demographic whammy, where not only is our population dynamics going to mean we have more people who need care, but those delivering care are increasingly retiring because they're those same boomers. And so what's the solution at a time also where we're seeing federal government policy being, let's turn down immigration, let's reduce our growth. Zero population growth for 2 years means how do we replace many of those health professionals, personal care workers, others to be able to deliver this care? So I think it's going to be the conversation that politicians don't want to have, but I know the public does. And for advocates listening and others, this is going to be a moment where how we deal with this health system, I think, can be a very politically powerful conversation.
Well, and I think certainly when I'm talking to people out there, and as we know from polling you've done with us, the fact that a lot of baby boomers have not planned for any kind of chronic disease or any kind of specialized care, nor do they expect their family members to look after them and care for them. So where will the burden of care rest? There is an expectation that the help will be there, that the care will be there. And I think the recognition is it's not. And so as people increasingly need more supports, and then they end up being on wait lists, it's becoming far more obvious to people that there's a problem and that that problem is only going to get worse. And we do worry, certainly in our association among our members, about rural communities. If you're in a rural community, there's probably no home care. There's no housing. There's no transportation. If you had an urgent care clinic or a hospital, it may well have closed. It's where we don't have primary care doctors or nurses. And so then what is the future of rural care and living look like in Canada when you think about our geography? And then the urban centers, we have very different issues. That being said, we still have supply issues. So as our baby boomers retire out, we're pinching the workforce at the other end and we're not replenishing it. And so these discussions around immigration policy and workforce management and reimagining really are pivotal.
I also think a lot about how short-term politics is and even policy making. And I say that there's lots of people in government and in other organizations that are thinking long-term, but the actual mechanisms of government are very short-term, like in a four-year horizon. But these are big long-term issues that catch up to governments. And I think immigration is a perfect example of how the scarcity mindset I described earlier shifted public opinion around immigration itself that forced governments to respond. But had they done the planning and the work to prepare both the health system and the housing stock to respond to this massive increase in our population, the public wouldn't have reacted as negatively as they did. And I do think there's a lesson there on healthcare and on long-term care, that if governments think that they are going to be able to not invest, not plan, not prepare for this wave that we have known, by the way, for a long time, we've seen this bulge moving through the age pyramid. And so the public's response is there's no excuse for not preparing.
I'm curious, from your research, do you think that the public is open to more radical change?
I think they are. When people perceive that the status quo isn't working or delivering for them, they become more open-minded to it. I do think private delivery still is a hurdle for a lot of people. There's this prevailing kind of anti-corporate, anti-profit mentality that's built into this affordability challenge. But that doesn't replace the idea that, at the same time, many people are deeply skeptical about government's ability to do things. So I think that very nuanced and mixed perception creates opportunities for disruption. And when I say disruption, I mean alternative ways of doing things. But at the core of it, you've got to demonstrate that ultimately the outcome you seek, the objective is still well-intentioned and good. And that's to deliver better quality care to people. And if you're there, I think the public will accept it and maybe even embrace it and support it outright. But when things are fine, nobody's looking to change anything. Things aren't fine in most people's minds. And that, I think, creates a lot of demand for new ideas.
One question I'd love to get your thoughts on, David, is around this notion of aging in place. So we know from other polling that people want to stay at home and they think they're going to be able to stay in their family home. We hear a lot from politicians and from others that that's the ideal and that's what they're going to make possible. But we do know that one in five individuals over the age of 80 will require some specialized long-term care support because they won't be able to be cared for safely in their home environment.
So can I hold you there before you ask your question? One in five over 80. So as we have discussed before, that number is going to triple.
Yes.
Over the next 10 to 15 years. Do you think we're ready? Do we have triple the capacity that we have now?
No. And our wait list in Ontario is now closer to 50,000 people waiting. And even if we do meet the commitment that the government of Ontario has made to build or rebuild 58,000 new spaces in long-term care, we will still have a wait list of at least 50,000 people.
Here's my take on that. You know, yes, I think it's completely natural for everybody to want to live at home and age in place as long as they possibly can. I can't imagine anyone saying, no, I'm ready to leave when I'm, you know, when I can still walk out of my home. The research we did with you showed that there's still a general desire to stay at home as long as I possibly can. Fine. But that doesn't mean it's possible. And so the moment that it is not possible becomes the moment where that caregiver or those that are going to be asked to care and support that person who can't stay at home, if there is no space, what happens?
Well, exactly. And there's a consequence to that. What I would say to end us on a happier note is that Ontario's long-term care is not the long-term care of 2019. The government of Ontario has done more than any other jurisdiction in terms of investments and bringing in new models of care, new approaches supporting dementia care, supporting what they call emotion-focused care, to build bridges and transitions between hospital and long-term care as we move forward. I'd be interested in your insights as to whether or not there's actually any public recognition of those investments and the fact that there has been leadership, certainly by this province, in driving some change, not just on building new buildings.
I haven't done a lot of work in this space to know whether the public's aware of all those investments and changes to improve the system, but I look at it indirectly to say, I don't see evidence that it's a flashing red light in people's minds, which means, you know, if people aren't saying it's a problem or a big problem, then they don't perceive it is. And that's usually a good sign for policymakers in that it's not raising those kind of red flags anymore. I think politically, the government, the provincial government in Ontario, has spent some money telling Ontarians how it's investing, whether it be in new schools or new long-term care homes. They've been telling that story in terms of the investment that they're making. And if you look at simply the fact of, you know, in our polling anyways, you know, the government, the incumbent party, performs best among those over 60. And that's partly because of their politics, but also the government has shown, at least to your point, an understanding and empathy with people who are at that stage, whether they're caregivers or they're increasingly at a position to needing care. So I don't think people could articulate as clearly about what's happened in the system. But I think if you look back to where we were 5 years ago, where people totally understood that the system was under incredible pressure because of the pandemic, I don't believe that people would describe it in overly negative ways today. And that, I think, is a reflection of both your members' work, but also the government's promise to improve it. That's good progress, I would say. But it also doesn't remove the fact that people are also increasingly aware of the capacity needs that are coming. Don't stop building, because the population is going to continue to grow. I think the big challenge long-term, and maybe we're going off here a little bit, is like these population bulges means that you may need to increase capacity in the system.
We're feeling a bit of a shift where I think during the pandemic, the issue of quality in long-term care really was top of mind. Those old buildings needed to be replaced. What we are hearing increasingly now is about access. We're not talking a lot about premature admissions into long-term care when you have almost 50,000 people waiting. The majority of our admissions now are direct from hospital. And the family members just want to get the care. They want to make sure that it's going to be there for their loved one. And then I think there's an underlying belief, which I think is that if they are able to have their loved one admitted and moved into a long-term care home, the care will be there for them. And I think those investments and changes have really helped. Is there more work to be done? Absolutely. We still have a long way to go, but we are in a much, much better place.
Just to add to something you said, is healthcare and care generally is all interconnected. So if you're somebody who's, you know, in your 30s, not thinking about your own needs when you're in your 80s, you still worry about hospital, emergency room, urgent care wait times. Guess what? That's related to whether a bed is available. That might be, you know, somebody who needs long-term care but can't get access to a long-term care bed, and so they're in a hospital longer than they absolutely need to, and it's more expensive to keep them there, and it's taking a bed of somebody who also might need one. So I think it's to constantly remind and not assume that people understand how, I mean, people understand how complex healthcare and long-term care is, but how integrated it all is. And you can't solve one problem without solving others. But how do you make it relevant to somebody like me or even younger than me? I'm not that young anymore, in my early 40s, is to expand that, to talk about how if we're not working the system well here, it's going to make it harder for you to get a family doctor or get access to urgent care when you might need it.
Well, and therein lies the challenge. We're part of a seniors alliance with all of the various associations. So the hospitals, primary care, geriatricians, mental health care, home care. And our action plan on that is it's the government needs to work with all of us together in tandem and not one at the expense of another part of the system.
When you ask people what's the top issues facing Ontario, very few are mentioning long-term care. It's not the thing keeping people up at night. It's not likely coming up often. If you're a candidate knocking on doors right now, that's not what people are saying. But they definitely are talking about capacity of the health system. And that's where you can really, as a candidate, offer a nuanced explanation that it requires support and investment and planning right across the whole system itself.
Well, thank you, David, for this. This has been super helpful, really insightful. We are facing what David Coletto calls a double demographic whammy. We're heading toward another perfect storm, a rapidly aging population and a shrinking supply of healthcare professionals that will strain healthcare, including long-term care, and dominate the political agenda for the next 5 to 10 years, unless the problems are addressed. Together, it looks like these trends will amplify healthcare scarcity, transforming it into the defining political issue for voters aged 45 and older, much as housing affordability has become central for younger Canadians. So, how are politicians and political parties planning to address these issues in their campaign strategies? We reached out to our friends at Crestview Strategy to hear their insights. Joining us for a panel discussion are Jenny Roth, a sought-after commentator appearing regularly on national television networks and a lifelong political activist, having most recently served as director of communications during Federal Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre's successful leadership campaign to become the leader of the opposition in Parliament in Canada. Gurratan Singh is an advocate, strategist, and former member of the Ontario Provincial Parliament with the New Democratic Party of Ontario. Gurratan has held several key roles in the Legislative Assembly of Ontario, including critic for the Attorney General and Deputy House Leader. He also holds extensive experience at provincial committees. Prior to his election, Gurratan practiced as a litigation lawyer representing clients across Ontario. Dan Moulton has served in politics in Canada for more than a decade and is a sought-after commentator, appearing regularly on national television networks to share perspectives from the Liberal Party. Across various roles, he has provided strategic leadership on some of the highest stakes files, including one of the largest initial public offerings in Canadian history, 2 minority government budgets, and a plan to cut the cost of electricity by 25%. Let's get started. I'm really delighted to be joined by you, Jenny, Dan, and Gurratan, as we really step back to think about what is the political landscape like in Canada. Jenny, why don't we start with you? As we think about heading into elections, what is the voter mindset and how is it informing how your party is actually thinking about making decisions?
Sure. I actually think there's almost a global voter mindset, at least in the Western world, around, yes, affordability, but also scarcity. And scarcity lends itself to the healthcare conversation, I think. This idea that, you know, there are too many people fighting over too little of everything, whether that's goods that are more expensive because of their scarcity, food and grocery stores, that sort of thing, or services like healthcare. And I think there was a time in the economy globally where people had a lot of optimism. And so there was a lot more room for ambitious programs that would reach people, equity-oriented language, that kind of policy that you heard at the beginning of the sort of Trudeau era in 2015, 2016. And now I think we're in this period where people feel they need to focus on what's most basic to them, their housing, their food, keeping their family safe in their communities, driving to work. And in the healthcare sector, I think that means more supply, more access to that which people don't have enough of. So there's a lot more we can discuss, but I think maybe I'll let my colleagues weigh in.
Jenny, he's bringing the voice of the Conservative Party. How about we move over to the Liberals, Dan?
You know, I think Jenny's right about her analysis on where the minds of voters are at and what's driving a lot of the anxiety around affordability and cost of living that really has been dominating public opinion polling on the top issues of voters. What I will say is I think that scarcity challenge applies to the Canadian healthcare system and Ontario's healthcare system in particular. Liberals are going to be working very hard to drive the conversation to be about the scarcity of family doctors, the scarcity of access to primary care in communities across the province. We're seeing stories of ERs in rural Ontario being forced to close, ERs in even suburban communities that are having huge staffing challenges, and that becomes really scary for a lot of people. But I think the change you're seeing in the top issues for voters is really being driven by a growing concern about the availability of healthcare.
Great, thanks. And so, Garatin, the NDP.
It's interesting because as we have this conversation around scarcity, what you're seeing right now is an argument being put forward by different spectrums of politics. And we have some that are saying in a moment of scarcity from the conservatives, we need to go down a specific route of what's described as smaller government, privatization, et cetera, as a solution towards these infrastructure or service issues that we're having around very fundamental things like healthcare. From progressives, from those on the left, from the NDP, you're going to actually see something very different. Our argument would be that it is a moment like now that you actually need to invest further within these institutions, and that we need to look at a model that is actually far more compassionate, a model that is far more focused on making sure that people are not left behind. I sat in the legislature and I was there during the pandemic. I was in Ontario and I remember hearing the report from the Army when they went into different health facilities, including long-term care facilities. I remember seeing the stark differences that existed between public, non-for-profit, and for-profit. And the NDP is going to continue this as a point of reference with regards to healthcare to say that a public model, a non-for-profit model, a model that is focused on just providing care and compassion to individuals is actually the best way we can help address this healthcare crisis and beyond by further investing in this system and keeping it public and in the hands of the people.
So to that point, on a number of our podcasts, we've been talking about that scarcity element, affordability versus quality versus accessibility. And to Ginny's point, this is a global discussion that we're actually having. And I'm curious, Ginny and Dan, whether you agree on this for-profit, not-for-profit positioning that we certainly see the NDP taking both provincially and nationally.
Well, you know, I just jump in quickly from the Liberal standpoint and say, you know, I think it's difficult for Liberals to live in a world in which you're talking about for-profit healthcare of any kind, right? I think like that statement for a Liberal is a contradictory statement, right? And so it is a difficult one to ever get behind or to introduce into policy in a public way during a campaign period. That said, the extent to which Liberals will be interested in focusing on those issues, profit in long-term care, models for delivery of long-term care, is a completely different question. In the last Ontario election campaign in 2022, there was a platform commitment around not-for-profit care. And I think that was driven largely by the issues that Garatin talked about, in that we were emerging from the global pandemic. That was a top issue for voters. The care of our elders, parents and grandparents, was something that people were talking about and people cared a lot about. I don't think that will be a predominant issue in the next campaign, whenever it comes. And I don't think Liberals are going to be focused on long-term care in the way that we were in 2022.
Thanks, Dan. Ginny?
I would just say I agree with everything Dan said. Some Liberals bring a traditional partisan Liberal perspective on healthcare, particularly at the federal level, where the Canada Health Act is sacred. Healthcare and public delivery are intertwined and sort of can never be separated. But I think that's changing because of the economic circumstances. I mean, look at housing, for instance. There was a bit of a consensus across the board that affordable housing had to be delivered by government or funded by government at different levels, maybe at the municipal level, and that was sort of the responsibility, that the market couldn't meet that need effectively. And I think now you're seeing such a scarcity challenge with housing that you see young Liberals, young progressives in the US who are saying, we can't, there's no room for dogma anymore, that the need for housing is just so dire that there needs to be, of course, be a role for the private sector, which can be more nimble, can bring greater financing, can move more quickly. And Canada, I think, is primed for a similar conversation, not just on housing, but on all kinds of services and necessities, in part because we've had a decade of federal Liberal government that has taken the approach of government is best to do things. And now public opinion saying, but you haven't been all that successful at that. Look at childcare. which is funded at the federal level and being administered at the provincial and municipal level, there is a sense that even though the government is pouring billions of dollars into funding subsidized childcare, people are just not getting access. And so I think access is starting to subsume and become even more important than affordability. And when it comes to healthcare, particularly long-term care, there are challenges for private providers around really needing to have strength when it comes to quality and safety and some of those really key important metrics that people want for their loved ones, particularly in the very sensitive moment of the later stages of their lives. But if private providers can meet those brand requirements and send those signals to the public, and then also be the ones who are building new facilities, building new beds, providing more care, adding to supply, then they're part of the solution to what is a very big, what feels like a very big intractable problem in healthcare. And so politicians have to be careful about that because they don't want to be seen to be allying with private interests that will work at the expense of the public. But I think that there's a lot of work that can be done between providers and governments and politicians to say, we can all jointly be part of a supply side solution, which in a moment of crisis where people feel like they just don't have access can solve problems quickly, particularly if they can meet standards.
From an NDP perspective, the response to Ginny's position would be, this is a page out of the Conservative playbook. The progressives would say that what has happened is historically we've seen public institutions like healthcare, like long-term care, be historically underfunded. And it's often underfunded through Conservative or Liberal governments. And we've seen this with federal health transfers being reduced over the decades. We've seen this with overall funding just not being where it needs to be. The argument that often funding will always be below inflation. So it looks like an increase, but it's not at inflation or beyond inflation. You're actually seeing cuts in it. And this is what has created a crisis. And then what happens is the solution to a crisis is always provided with privatization. Progressives would say the solution is actually with maintaining further funding at the level that is required to meet and match growth in population, growth with regards to different, you know, centers, urban centers, whatever, and making sure that that funding is adequate, especially federally as well, to keep a robust public healthcare system. And that this solution of privatization is kind of like a Trojan horse, right? You create a problem, you say it's privatization, and ultimately it creates a more expensive system, worse services for people, as we see in Quebec, where the study is very clear that private healthcare is more expensive, and ultimately a disservice to the people.
I'm going to just challenge each one of you on this. Ontario probably has done more in response to what happened in the pandemic than any other jurisdiction in the world, whether that's in Canada or in North America or globally. They've done more to move the needle, to move redevelopments, build new homes. And they have been able to do that through more private-public partnerships where the care, all of the care and long-term care in Ontario is actually publicly funded. So we have private operators, but it's publicly funded and publicly delivered care. I would also say, and this speaks to your point, Garotin, that was catch-up. So the pandemic exposed a lot of weaknesses in how we care for our seniors, had devastating consequences. The government acted, but we're just catching up. And we're at this point now where we now have 50,000 people waiting for long-term care in the province of Ontario alone. We're still way behind in the redevelopment of long-term care homes across the province. And I think our worry certainly is, to Dan's point, we're not an issue anymore. And so everyone thinks we've ticked that box, but yet at the same time, that wait list is only going to grow. And even if the province does build and rebuild 58,000 new spaces, the wait list will still be at a minimum 50,000 people and sustained over the next 10 to 20 years. You know, one thing we're trying to really get our heads around is governments think in four-year cycles. If it takes 4 to 5 years to build a new long-term care home, or 5 to 6 to 8 years to build a new hospital, how do we actually address those scarcity issues where you're dealing with an urgent need, a growing need, and yet the path to getting there?
I mean, you're right that governments tend to think in, frankly, even less than four-year cycles. If you assume the final year of a mandate is so hyper-political that they're thinking constantly about re-election, the first year of a mandate, it's difficult to get anything done. There's short periods of time to have impact. I think there's risk and opportunity to the unique case of long-term care, because there are people, voters, who sort of blissfully go through life unaware of the challenges with long-term care because they don't need to confront it. Certainly that was true for me over the last couple decades. But when you do have to confront it because you have a parent or an aunt or a grandparent facing that challenge, or you yourself are facing that challenge, all of a sudden it becomes all-consuming. It becomes the most important issue and it shoots up the list. And you have demographic trends. There's nothing about our demographics that means that long-term care is going to move off the issue list. It's going to move up the issue list. More and more people will confront that as our population ages. And so that can be politically potent. The people for whom an issue is the top issue are going to be highly motivated to vote on that issue or vote against someone on that issue. And so reminding politicians and governments about that and finding those people where they are as they're experiencing running up against the system and sort of channeling that emotion into something productive to have political influence, I think there's really big opportunity around that. And it'll be better for the province, because even if you personally are not confronting this issue, you will at some point in your life.
Unfortunately, that's true. Dan, any thoughts?
Well, I think one of the challenges here, of course, is that it's not something governments are particularly keen to talk about either, right? I think it's a really no-win political issue unless it's top of the front page, unless it's top of the minds of voters. It's really a difficult space for governments to feel like they have political win in, right? And it's part of the reason why you don't hear them celebrating the success of the Ontario model you talked about and some of the achievements of the current government, because it's just not where they want to invest their time, energy, and limited political communications opportunities is in this space, because they're not going to get the credit for it that, you might argue they deserved on it. So I think finding ways to bring light to not just the demographic challenges, but the human challenges, the stories that Jenny talks about that Ontarians are going to be increasingly facing because of that backlog, because of those wait lists, is the only way that you create an environment in which it is politically relevant to have a conversation about these challenges and see public policy introduced in a meaningful way. I think the association does an amazing job at, advocating with all sides of the political spectrum for the interests of its members. And I think that's why you do see, policy being introduced that the successes in the way that you've talked about. And I think that, that helps move the ball, but I think the challenge will always be, getting people to talk about this, getting this to be something that is seen as politically urgent in a moment where it needs to be, is the way that this actually leads to long-term change that you talk about.
We have value bringing a compassionate lens to this and making sure that we are still talking about the needs of our aging demographic and how each and every one of us has some accountability for ensuring that they actually get care when and where they need it. We've done as well as we have because the government has reacted to what happened in a crisis. And now we need to think about how do we collectively become more proactive and really try to meet that sense of urgency as the list grows.
I think you talk to people, though, who are like engaging with the system. I don't know if they would share that sentiment. I think that sometimes this is the division that exists between those who are dealing with the system and those who may have a bit of a higher up perspective of it in terms of not having to be on the receiving end of treatment. And I think that's when we talk about people's lived realities right now, the reality is that things like the affordability and housing crisis are so dominant that's, I think, consuming the political discourse. But if you talk to people who are engaging with that system, anyone who has an aging parent is concerned, and they're concerned about the levels of care and the amount of care that they experience in these facilities. And their mind will go back to what happened during the pandemic and the clear juxtaposition between for-profit and non-for-profit and public facilities.
I appreciate your comments on that. And I think to Jenny's point, mobilizing homes to actually tell that story about the quality improvement so that we're actually educating the public around what's happening in the homes and bringing more eyes into the homes. One of the challenges that every country is actually facing right now in terms of whether it's long-term care or healthcare more broadly really is in the health human resources space. Canada has the same problem. We are seeing this on the ground, and yet some recent decisions made by the government of Canada on immigration really are threatening our ability to maintain and build a new workforce to actually provide the care that we need. So I'd welcome your thoughts on that intersection where we see the impact of federal decisions on what's actually happening on the provincial front.
So you talk about the current moment that we're in based on some recent federal government decisions around immigration levels and a number of programs like the Temporary Foreign Worker Program, which were being identified as a source of problem and in many cases abuse by certain parts of corporate Canada. And so that environment, the place we're at in the political cycle, let's call it, of that issue, we're not going to see substantial change. We're not going to see a different dynamic. There's almost a universal consensus that where the government ended up on this was certainly politically the right decision, but for many, the right public policy standpoint. What comes next is the question, right? What is the next consensus on federal immigration policy as it relates to addressing the problems that exist, that you just described, which are not unique to this industry and are being experienced by a vast range of parts of Canada, of corporate Canada, that are very concerned about their ability to staff operations? And how do we design new federal programs to help meet that need? I think working with opposition, working with the current government to help drive that conversation, help lead to that consensus is really the only outcome, because there isn't going to be a retread, I think, in the short term on any of the decisions that have been made. It needs to be about redesigning new programs to help to meet that need and helping to understand, you know, what the impacts on your operations are from the absence of programs to do that.
Ginny?
I have a slightly more optimistic take, maybe. I agree, there's not going to be change in the short term. But I think the government moving under pressure to change the system has taken some heat out of the issue. And a change in government could lead to a dynamic where there can be a path to sort of restoring a broad-based consensus on immigration, that if it's managed in a certain way, which is to say levels are high relative to the rest of the world, among the highest, but still reasonable relative to our housing, our healthcare, et cetera. And that within those levels, there are programs that are designed to prioritize either existing skills among new Canadians or young new Canadians who are eager to be trained in the skills that we need. For instance, in health, human resources, we can get back to a place where industry sectors, the provinces can feed into the government about their needs, and the federal government can set a plan forward that tries to meet those needs. And actually, there could be areas where the government's even more aggressive about recruiting new Canadians in areas where we need to. But, you know, the heat has to be taken out of the issue politically first. And then, frankly, I think the economic growth imperative for a new government will be so strong that immigration will have to play a role, not just in sectors like healthcare, where we're bordering on crisis levels of inability to staff hospitals, doctors' offices, long-term care facilities, but in construction, in all these other industries that we need to see growth in order for the broader economy to grow and in order for people to do better. So I feel pretty optimistic. I think it will take some time. And I think Dan's right. The stakeholders who can have the highest impact in influencing that need to be part of influencing the process. But I think over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, there's a lot of room for optimism.
We like optimism. We favor it. Gratin, any thoughts on the immigration policy and the challenges around health, human resources?
So a few things. I think that the reality of a part of this conversation is an aging population within Canada. And we're entering an era where the largest population segment at one point are now going to be aging and exiting the workforce and all the impacts that has on other forms of healthcare, long-term care, otherwise. And we need immigration. We need immigration to ensure that we are able to provide the services and keep our economy robust. I think we have to recognize that there's a variety of discourses happening on immigration right now, and a lot of it's very problematic. So there's an increase, I would say, of xenophobia. There's an increase of a rhetoric, which is very against immigrants. And I don't think it's to the point Ginny made, it's been too politicized. And I think a big part of it is to look at this pragmatically and say that all of Canada requires immigrants. So I think the conversation needs to be depoliticized, and we need to ensure that we're looking at it from a very pragmatic lens. And I think beyond that, when we talk about workforce, I think this is where there's a huge opportunity to work with unions to make sure that we're not just bringing in workers, but we're putting them through a funnel that allows them to get the training they require and the support of a union. And we've been hearing interesting conversations from unions saying, we, you know, within the trades, within healthcare, otherwise, saying that, yeah, there's a huge opportunity right now to bring in workers, and they want to be a part of that conversation. They want to work with government and say, these are the gaps we have, and we can work with government to bring in workers, be it in healthcare, trades, otherwise, make sure they're unionized, given those supports, and then they're entering the Canadian workforce in a far more supportive way than is happening in many ways now.
Well, and I would say one of the things coming out of the pandemic, certainly from our sector perspective, I don't think I'd had so many conversations with our labor partners as I did during the pandemic. And those conversations continue as we find common ground on what the gaps are. And then we are having global discussions, actually, around ethical workforce recruitment. And we're looking at trends, instead of having permanent residents, having people come in on visas that are time limited so they can then go back to their home country if they wish and actually provide a service there rather than us taking all of their labor away. So there are some bigger discussions that are happening at various tables as we think about we're sharing a global workforce. It's fixed for all of us. And so our worry too, though, to your point, Dan and Ginny, about the timelines, if you lose 18 months in a very competitive environment, when we're all going to the Philippines or we're going to Africa, or we're going to India to try and recruit a workforce, other countries are actually moving ahead of us and establishing those structured relationships and contractual relationships in many cases, country to country, around how they're going to support one another. But I'm wondering, as we think about potential elections and some of the trends that we've been seeing in our discussion with David Coletto, he did talk about the risk to incumbents. Well, so I really want to thank each of you for your insights and for joining us and sharing, and to your leadership. We love working with Team Crestview and really look forward to following you in the media and your punditry as the political landscape unfolds. Thank you.
Thanks, Donna.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
What a timely, rich, and nuanced conversation. We are so grateful to David, Ginny, Garatan, and Dan for sharing their perspectives with us. Whether you're in Canada or elsewhere in the world, it's clear that aging populations are a critical factor in shaping political priorities and policies. From voters' intentions to campaign strategies, the way seniors' care is approached will undoubtedly influence the future of healthcare, not just for Canada, but for countries facing similar challenges around the world. As we've discussed today, seniors' care is a key issue that will affect all of us, whether it's today's older generations or those of tomorrow. So, as we head into our next elections, let's continue to ask ourselves, how do we make aging and seniors' care a priority? And how do we ensure that the voices of older adults and their families and caregivers are heard loud and clear? Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so we can reach more listeners interested in our community of change makers in seniors' care. I'm your host, Donna Duncan. See you next time. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Arjo. Arjo believes that empowering movement within healthcare environments is essential to quality care. With products and solutions that are designed to promote a safe and dignified experience through patient handling, medical beds, personal hygiene, disinfection, and the prevention of pressure injuries and venous thromboembolism, Arjo is committed to driving healthier outcomes for people facing mobility challenges. Learn more about Arjo solutions at www.arjo.ca.